Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins, and I'm in London with my colleagues Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Morrison-Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us all the way from Tucson, Arizona, some ungodly and very un-rock and roll hour of the morning, is the superbly monikered Kid Congo Powers. Welcome.
Hello. Good to be here.
Great to have you here, Kid. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for... Well, you said your cats wake you at 5 o'clock anyway, so maybe
exactly.
Me feel slightly better about asking you to get up so your excellent memoir, Some New Kind of Kick, is being published in the UK next week. I absolutely loved it. And, of course, some credit must go to RBP contributor Chris Campion, who was a guest on this very podcast in July 2019. Mm. He talked about Charles Manson and the Mamas and the Papas. memory serves. Yeah. And he's a desert dweller also, is he not?
Yes.
Kid?
Yes.
So shout out to Chris. In the book, Kid, you mentioned that when you first met the Gun Club's Geoffrey Lee Pierce, I think queuing up to see Pear Rupert at the Whiskey, in 1979, you'd never played guitar and you were thinking at that point of trying your hand as a music writer. So given this is Rocks Back Pages, what rock writing influenced you growing up in East LA in the early 70s?
Well, you know, I came of age in the era of glam rock. So, you know, actually it was more the writing of, it was almost fanzine writing of Rock Scene magazine and also Cream magazine, of course. But Rock Scene was really like what I was looking at because it was kind of half gossip rag and half, you know, music criticism and journalism. And I was interested in both of those aspects. And so, you know, Richard Robinson, Danny Fields, you know, Robert Christgau in Cream magazine, you know, these were people I was reading. I really always liked essays by actual artists, you know, that always was what I liked hearing, because I liked hearing from the actual artists, like, you know, Patti Smith or Lenny Kaye, who had a moniker of Doc Rock and wrote under that, but everyone knew it was Lenny Kaye, even though I didn't know who Lenny Kaye was. He was the guy who put the Nuggets compilation together. So those were things that I was looking at the time, you know.
Where would you find Rock Scene magazine in LA, and how did you happen upon Rock Scene?
It would be it had a pretty wide distribution, so I would find it at newsstands, mostly in Hollywood, or, you know, or music related record stores, places like that would be where I would find it. And it was immediately, you know, taken away by this whole mostly New York centric scene. You know, if it had pictures of Lou Reed and David Bowie in it, I wanted to read about it and see it. And it had many, you know, them hanging out at Max's or whatever, you know, Max's Kansas City. And that kind of thing was intriguing to me. And I was like, you know, I want to be there. And how do I get there? I write about it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You write about New York. I mean, the book is very much, you know, you're in New York one minute, you're back in LA the next, and you're in New York. But there's a lot about New York. And I think your first experience of New York was like a school trip. You were there for like a day, weren't you?
Yeah.
And you sort of crammed as much sleep into that day as you could. And then I think went to London, right?
If
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, that was, I hoodwinked my parents into getting me this because I was going to quit high school. And I said, there's nothing more for me to learn here. And so they said, and I knew there was this trip to Europe with the school, you know, and I was actually on the school newspaper staff and was the music critic for my high school newspaper, bringing the word of great avant music to suburban high schoolers in a Chicano community. And
I can see Mark's already thinking, we have to get that on Rock's Back Pages.
Yes. I have copies.
You do have copies. I do. Be careful what you sort of half offer here.
Yeah. So anyway, I knew this trip was coming, and I said, well, I really want to go on this trip. What if I, you know, I wanted to quit school, but actually, no, my parents knew I wanted this trip. And they offered, like, if you take what they call here a GED test, which is an equivalency test to graduating high school, we'll send you on this trip. So I was like, you know, immediately got the test and did it. And so yeah, that was my way to get somewhere, you know, to go to record stores and holy grail sites of different places in Europe, you know, in the UK. But London was definitely, I had my sights on London and really just was a dream to go there, being a British music rock fan for so long, as from the earliest teen years to later teen years at that point. And yeah, so that got me my first taste, and I got my first taste of in London. You know, I was like, okay, I have to go to a concert. I have to go see something that punk rock is happening. I have to go. And I was like, what's happening tonight? Because I'm only here one night. And there was a concert at a club called The Vortex on Water Street.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
And it was The Slits and The Prefects and Tanya Hyde and The Tormentors, who I've not heard of before or since.
Or since.
but they were tormented. And so, yeah, so that was like a real experience, completely different culture, different punk culture than than the Ramones and the American version of punk rock at the time. And yeah, I was, you know, immediately left the concert and chopped all my hair off in the dorm room and, you know, left a pile of hair in the sink and was on my way. Yeah. So yeah. And I remember very vividly that at the show that the DJ was playing Gary Gilmore's Eyes by The Adverts, which apparently was a new and very popular song at the club. And it really just electrified the entire audience before any band even came on. And it was just so exciting to me, you know, and immediately went out and bought that record. And yeah, so it was the start of my British, and it was a more visceral foray into what I only read about in magazines, you know. So experience being the best teacher.
Just to rewind your tape very slightly, I think you talk about one of the first shows you saw in LA, which was Frank Zappa and the Mothers at the Hollywood Bowl. I wanted to ask you about, you know, specifically the Cruising with Ruben and the Jets album. Given your Mexican-American background, you grew up in La Puente, a suburb in East LA. And I know you were already a Zappa. Were you already a Zappa fan before the Ruben and the Jets thing took off?
Well, this will be a matter of pinpointing time, but I knew more about like Freak Out and Absolutely Free and We're Only in It for the Money, all the Mothers of Invention, and this was because I had a next door neighbor who was my older sister's age, but saw that I had an aptitude for rock music, and
I love the word aptitude.
Yes, I was ready for it, and he saw that I might be a good person to corrupt with the ways of the underground at the time, you know, and so yeah, he was a big Zappa fan. You know, he's a painter, artist himself, a young guy. Steve Escandone, and he knew about R. Crumb and you know, Furry Freak Brothers and different, all kinds of things. But he was first and foremost a big Zappa aficionado, and so he exposed me to that, and I immediately was attracted to it. You know, I was in. It was funny. It was irreverent. The music was strange. It was snarky and, you know, all the things that I was probably 15, you know, at the time. So, you know, it was incredibly appealing, and they were freaks.
Oh, they were freaks.
They were freaks. Freaks, daddy.
the reason partly that I mentioned the Reuben and the Jets album is because LeBeau just died by coincidence. And, you know, that album, for any listeners who don't know, was a sort of homage, wasn't it, to that era, to the shows that Art put on at the El Monte Legion Stadium, old like doo-wop and street corner sort of groups. And I just wondered whether and very much with that sort of Chicano kind of edge to it, I think. Is that fair to say? Is that how you remember it? And were you struck by that as a kid?
I was struck by that as a kid because it was Art LeBeau and oldies, as they call it, oldies music, lowriders and Mexican-Americans were listening to in my neighborhood at the time. That was incredibly prevalent everywhere, you know, in school and what I heard and what my older sisters were listening to. And so Reuben and the Jets was a familiar, and it was half homage, and it was pretty hilarious too, you know. Yes. You know, so it was half homage and half a bit, you know, making fun of it and a bit snarky about it. I think now, in hindsight, it's more homage than anything, and it's one of my favorite albums of all time.
Yeah,
you know, right now, and I think a huge influence on what I do in music, you know, and what I like, and I credit it to that was a way in for me to tap into more Chicano roots. You know, it was not necessarily coming from the direct music, but Frank Zappa reworked it into a form that made sense to me, to a rebellious me, and to a brain that wants to rework everything, because who knows why.
Mark, you saw the Mothers, didn't you? I think you saw in at the Albert Hall. Did you see the Mothers?
Yeah. I saw them at Rainbow. I saw them the night that Zappa was pushed off stage.
Oh, of course, yeah. Which was a little bit later.
It was a little bit later. I was right at the back of my memories. They had blue light on the stage. And just seeing this pair of trousers descending like that, white trousers going down.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, the band stopped and everything stopped. And that was the end of the show. And he broke his legs very badly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Which added to his hatred of England. Paradoxical hatred, because I actually met him. I was friends with John Mayall's kids at school, and Frank was a big friend of their mum's, and he used to come, he would be over there. He told me off for rolling a joint at their kitchen table.
Yeah, he was anti-drug.
Oh, he was very, very much so.
When I went to see him, I was expecting, you know, the Mothers of Invention, but it was actually, it was right before or right at the time that he had an album called The Grand Wazoo, which actually had orchestra playing. Mm-hmm. And so it was like a little confusing because I said, oh, there's an orchestra on stage and they're doing a lot of instrumentals and they're doing a lot of, you know, but they did, you know, a lot of Hot Rats and this and that, but with strings. And it was quite incredible and impressive. And I will say the bill was Frank Zappa. Next was The Doors minus Jim Morrison.
The late
Jim Morrison, and the audience was not having it at all. And it was just strange for LA, huh? And then the opening was Tim Buckley.
Not bad at all.
Yeah, so that was a great first concert.
Can we jump forward to... from the Hollywood Bowl to Rodney's English Disco. Here's little Brian Tristan in this sort of den of iniquity on Sunset with all these sort of rock and roll nymphettes running around. I mean, how do you remember? How did you get in the first place? And was that sort of your kind of glitter rock baptism?
Yeah, you know, I will say I probably got there a little bit late in the game. You know, I wasn't there at the start of Rodney's, but, you know, I was very young. What I did, I knew about it and I wanted to go, and I luckily had older friends with cars that would drive there, other rock and roll kids I knew. And my way, I don't know how we got in, being underage, but there was a lot of underage kids in there. I will tell you that much.
So it wasn't very difficult to get in, actually.
Yeah. But what happened is I met some people I was interested to meet, and there was a lot of young people, and what we would do was, there was a back alleyway that had, went in the back of the club, and we would go and drink back there. I made friends with all these kids who were underage and couldn't get in, but they wanted to be there. And we would, drink a terrible Rainer's ale and, you know, take pills and have fun. And, but then it would seem like later in the evening, the age restriction just left and everyone was let in. But it was a time, you know, all these kids wanted to be there and be close to rock stars and rock music and be, you know, we wanted to be involved, and that was a way to be completely involved and to be able to dress up and prance around and preen and just like they talked about in the songs, you know, we took our cues from Rebel Rebel or whatever, you know. Yeah. So there was that was a thing, and you know, and I, you know, I was pretty sure I was a gay kid by then. Yeah, I was, you know, I was attracted to males, and I did notice that a lot of the older men in their sheer tops and platform boots were probably not gay men, you know, but they were really attracted to the very young women that were there. But there was a lot of like gay high school kids there, you know, that were there for the excitement of the music and to just be part of it. But it was definitely a sleazy scene, you're going down there, but it didn't matter to me. I was young. I didn't care about these other people. You know, we were the stars.
Yeah.
I mean, you write beautifully in the book about the LA scene, which has always fascinated me. And so that kind of dovetails very neatly with all the people you write about, the kind of beginning of the punk rock scene in Los Angeles, which was earlier than most people think, right? I mean, everyone just mm-hmm. assumes that LA just sort of copied New York and London, mm. but there was a lot going on pretty early on, wasn't there? And you were around a lot of the scenesters that started forming bands, and you yourself, you know, were one of them. And the great story of Jeffrey Lee Pierce basically asking if you wanted to play guitar in a band with him, and you just said, I don't play guitar. I've never even picked up a guitar. And he said, hey, I believe you can play guitar, right? And yeah. Jeffrey was someone that you encountered relatively early, I guess. I mean, mm-hmm. not mid-70s, but late 70s, you encountered him.
Yeah.
He certainly wasn't a typical of anything, was he, Jeffrey? I mean,
no.
Tell us briefly about the late Jeffrey Lee Pierce.
Yeah, he was not a trendy one, you know. He wasn't. Right. He was actually, when I encountered him, he was done up in the most strangest of style, you know. He was the Deborah Harry Blondie fan club president. He was adopting his would later become the Marilyn Monroe from hell image he coined himself. And so he already, you know, he had like these ribbons in his hair, and he had a trench coat belted very tightly, and some like, you know, 50s girls' saddle shoes on. And it was just like, I was like, who is this strange creature here, you know? But it wasn't like cross-dressing. It was just, it was something else, you know, maybe just bad style, but great style, very original. And yeah, so I had seen him before, because I had worked at Bomp Records, you know, Greg Shaw's record store. And that was one of the earliest stores that dealt in British import records and as a storefront. And Jeffrey would come in and peruse the, you know, mostly the reggae 12-inch records that would come in. And so I knew him from in a customer clerk kind of way. And we had seen each other around at every single show that ever happened in LA, you know, in that time, because there was nonstop shows going on and there were only a handful of the same people, you know, making the rounds. Yeah, so he just struck up a conversation, you know, feeling like perhaps he knew me because we've seen each other, and that we were early in line to see Para Ubu, you know, that, you know, being at in the front was, you know, paramount. It had to happen. It just had to happen, and you know, you weren't experiencing it, so that you were right there. So yeah, at the end of our conversation, we had talked about traveling. We talked about, because he had traveled to see music, and I, you know, I traveled in New York and London, and we were, yeah. He just said like, "Oh, you should be in a band. You know, you seem like someone who should be in a band, and you should play guitar, and I'll be the singer." And I was like, "Well, I don't play guitar." And he's like, "Well, I'll show you. I know this way. It's really easy. The blues guitarists, they tune their guitar to open E, and then they just play with a slide." And I was already enamored with the slide because, right, not because of necessarily blues music, but I had been to New York and seen the No Wave. So it was more like Lydia Lunch or Pat Place and the Contortions, who are using slide guitar in more of an experimental expressionist sort of way. You know, these things were, that was exciting to me. And so I thought, well, that seems doable. Okay, let's start a band. Here we go. Yeah, I didn't expect that we would be playing so soon.
No. And that was Creeping Ritual, right?
Yes.
The original sort of pre-Gun Club, it was The Creeping Ritual, which was a hilarious name. I've got an email from Don Snowden earlier this week, because he wrote a wonderful piece about Pharoah Sanders for us the other day.
Okay.
And I mentioned that you were going to be on the podcast. And so he said, just curious, did he talk in his book about us working at the Licorice Pizza in the San Fernando Valley? And I said, yes, he does talk about the Licorice Pizza. And he had this very funny story, which may trigger some memory. When all of us were anxiously waiting for Give Him Enough Rope to come in, it was when Chic's La Freak hit. And all the Chicano kids in the hood came looking for it. And they asked to hear the first few seconds of La Freak. And as soon as they heard it, they slapped their dollar down and off they went. Which I think is a lovely story. Well, I would take La Freak over Give Him Enough Rope probably any day.
Yes. I concur.
I think we're all on the same page.
I think so.
So, I mean, you know, one of the great things about this book and about your sort of status in the world of the music we're talking about is that you worked with three of the most extraordinary frontmen and figures in music, namely Jeffrey, Lux Interior of the Cramps, and then Nick Cave. What a sort of wonderfully unholy trinity that is. And you didn't play on the first couple of Gun Club records, but you came back to Jeffrey, and you're on The Las Vegas Story and Mother Juno. I just, a sort of quick question I'll pass on is, you know, Jeffrey is someone who is certainly not being forgotten, but he doesn't have the sort of status, right, that I like a Nick Cave has. And you sort of touch on this in the book, which I think is really interesting. You're saying, like, Nick has had much, however fucked up he was, had more of a support system around him, and Jeffrey kind of didn't. My question to you would be, do you think that Jeffrey was an influence on Nick, and has Nick ever acknowledged that? In terms of the whole sort of gothic kind of evil preacher Americana sort of thing that Nick did.
That's very difficult to say because they came up at the same time, you know. So I know they admired each other, As, and you know, maybe Jeffrey was a little bit, maybe the Gun Club a little before. I think it's coincidental myself, you know, but I think there was a great admiration. I think Nick has great admiration for Jeffrey for sure, and related to him and was a friend to him. And I don't think he would have been a friend to him if he didn't admire him, you know. So yeah, that's a difficult, that's a very chicken in the egg sort of question. Because I, to me, it coincides, you know, their interest in this, in blues music, you know.
Yes.
And the preacher. I mean, certainly when I saw the birthday party, it was a howl from very deep within, which, you know, which Jeffrey also, you know, encompassed, you know. So I think they were both already dedicated to the howl within, you know.
Yes.
And I think blues music actually spoke to both of them, you know, as a medium to that it was something coming from deep within, you know, this kind of music and this kind of sometimes almost experimental element of blues music, you know, that can be very loose, you know. There's the traditions, of course, but then if you listen to, you know, live John Lee Hooker bootleg, you know, it's really something else, you know. He's got all over the place, he's following his whims, and you know, it's a beautiful exploration, like probably not unlike free jazz sometimes, you know. You know, that he's going places, you know, and taking you there. And these, I think, were the interests of someone like Jeffrey or Nick, you know, that could be. When people say to me all the time, oh, Jeffrey is so unsung, he's so not, you know, for one, he's not lived long enough to capitalize more on a career, but also he, to me, he's very influential. I mean, to hear what people say to me about Jeffrey Lee Pierce when fans talk to me and other artists talk to me, even younger artists, I mean, he's so important to them and he's so influential. So to me, it's, I feel like he's as influential as Nick Cave is on people's lives. I think the depth with which he touched people is equal. You know, numbers may be something else, but
there's a very poignant thing. And one of the pieces that feature on the homepage is this piece that, you know, our mutual friend Fast Freddie Patterson wrote when you and Jeffrey had been kind of reunited. So this is April 1988, and you basically drive around like rock and roll Hollywood with Freddie and Jeffrey, and like pointing out places you used to live and shoot heroin and so forth. and this is a poignant bit where Jeffrey talks about living fast and dying young, and he's underage because I didn't die, he says. And Freddie says, if you had died, they would have canonized you. and then you, kid, say, well, they love Jim Morrison and they love Johnny Thunders. Even though he's not dead, he still qualifies as somewhat dead. And Jeffrey then says, they're really serious about the rock and roll rebel idea. I think he's talking about like fans in France and places like that. Really serious about the rock and roll rebel idea of let's do heroin and spill whiskey on each other and die young. But when you get into your late 20s, you start thinking, hey, man, maybe I don't want to die young. And obviously he's at that point, you know, he's sort of 10 years away from dying pretty young, didn't he? He died at 37.
Yeah,
I mean, I never saw the Gun Club play, but I did meet Jeffrey once with Harvey Kubinick when he was doing one of his like spoken word albums, and I remember talking to Jeffrey, and then going into the bathroom after he'd been in there, and there was like a Works light sitting on top of the loo, you know, that's a syringe for anyone not. You know, the
full junkie glossary.
Mama. Gone now. It's no use to listen.
Should we talk about the Cramps? How can we not talk about the Cramps? I must have seen you with the Cramps a couple of times. I did see you with the Cramps once in London and one in that one, the Reseda Country Club show you mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that. And so, I mean, tell us this extraordinary when they headhunt you.
In full costume.
You'd seen them play in New York and everything, but suddenly out of the blue, you get a call from Larks and Ivy. So tell us about them.
Yeah, so I'd been playing with the Gun Club for 1 year. I picked up the guitar, and the Gun Club was about 1 year old. And we were playing at clubs and, the cute young things and that other bands like, but we had about 10 fans. And Lux and Ivy were, unbeknownst to me, relocating to Los Angeles and looking for a new guitar player because their guitar player before, Brian Gregory, who was very much a kind of face of the Cramps.
Scary face.
Yeah, very scary face. But he had, absconded in the night and left the band with their van full of equipment. And so they were needing someone new. Some mutual friends, many people are claiming this, that I told them to go see you. But I remember it was Christian Hoffman from the Mumps and Bradley Field from Teenage Jesus. They told Lux and Ivy, go see this guy. Met him before. He's a fan of yours. And they have a song about Ivy. They're kind of a Cramps spin-off sort of, idea, whatever. And so they came and Lux taped the show with his cassette recorder with a microphone and under the cassette recorder under his coat. And I heard they were there. Dave Alvin from the Blaster said, "Oh, I saw Lux and Ivy. They were taking notes. They had a notepad. They were taking notes." And
that I can believe.
I know. They had a doctor's lab coat. No, but a stethoscope. A few days later, I get a phone call. And they say, "We're going to come over and have a talk with you." And I say, "Ooh, hello. Okay." And what do I wear? And so Ivy just came out. Ivy did all the talking. She just said, "Well, do you want to be in the Cramps?" And I was like, "Well, yes." And she said, "Okay, then you can be in our band," or whatever. And I was like, "Okay, well," and I asked, "What should I do? Do you want me to audition or, just what would happen next to make this happen?" And she said, "Well, what would you sacrifice to be in the Cramps? You just have to answer this question." And I said, "Well, quit my band or relocate or quit going to college or, something like that. I'd sacrifice those things." And she said, "No, nothing like that. I want to know, would you cut off a finger to be in our band?" I thought about it for 1 second and I said, "Yeah, I think I would." And she said, "Okay, you're in the Cramps now."
That was the right answer. Yes, I would cut off a finger.
I love that moment in the book as well because you describe it as it seemed quite drastic, not least considering they wanted you to play guitar, which is very funny. I guess, what the hell? It's only a finger. You've got 10 of them.
They had seen me and knew I only play with one finger.
Right.
So one slide, finger, good asset.
You can afford to lose
one of them.
That is very funny.
I think it's also the moment immediately after that in the book where you go and ask Jeffrey whether it's okay for you to quit the Gun Club and you don't know what to do. And he's sort of like, "Are you insane to even ask? Of course you should join the Cramps," which is lovely in itself as well.
Yeah. He was like, and Jeffrey immediately had his own interests there. He's like, "Yes, join the Cramps and make sure you get the Gun Club on bills with the Cramps when they play." Right. Which I did keep that. But then I was later thinking what? He's already has a gun. He's already replaced me, and I haven't even left the band yet. He had no. He didn't occur to him that he was stopping.
And of course, you had to have
everyone went.
You had to have a Cramps name. It's also the great stories. Great story. Cramps.
Yes.
You can't be called Brian Tristan. You have to have a Cramps name. So they just devised this wonderful name for
it. Yes. So, well, Lux Interior was always appointing people characters, you know. And so he was like, oh, you know, yeah, you should, hey, look at this picture. And he showed me a picture of Kid Thomas. And it was a blues shouter who, this giant pompadour, like a big, he was African-American man with a giant, greasy pompadour. And I actually had a bit of a pomp at the time. And, and I was a little rockabilly influence, going on, a greasy haired. And he said, like, oh, you should be like kid something. You should be like this. And then we were trying to think of all these things. And then he looked down and there was this, voodoo candle, a Santeria candle, actually. You know, of course, this just sitting around their house. And, and it said on it, it was called the Congo candle. And, you know, and then it tells you what happens when you light the candle. And it said, when you light this candle, Congo powers will be revealed to you. And, and he said, there's your name right there, Kid Congo Powers.
I'll see you on the one.
That's great.
And here I am.
All these years later.
Yeah, and here you are, revealed to us.
Yes. Yes. still answering to the names. Well,
yes. That's
right. I mean, as a gay Mexican American, did you? I mean, everyone was like a misfit on all these scenes, but you talk, you use that word misfit. I mean, do you think you felt any more of a misfit than anybody else because of your background and ethnicity?
Well, definitely so. You know, I was gay, Chicano, self-taught. You know, I was just all of these. You know, if we want to get on the psychiatrist couch right now,
how did you guess?
Yes, but you know, that was always a source of those sexuality and ethnicity. And being Chicano, it was always a source of otherness for me because I always felt, okay, I'm not part of the white American mainstream. I never will be. I am a second-class citizen. I am looked down upon, you know, all of these, even as incredibly assimilated, you know, and my parents were born in America.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't, you know, first generation, but this still plays into your world and psyche, you know, that America is, you know, white, you know, white middle class, you know, male dominated heterosexual world, you know, and that was also, you know, in rock music, you know, too, you know, we had our Mexican heroes, you know, and I met people like Frank Zappa paying homage to this. But that outsiderness, yeah, and misfit, because not only that, I was an artist, you know, and liked all these things that were not of mainstream culture. And whereas that was a liberation and exciting and a ticket into an absolute other world, it was also a way that I could feel like, you know, there was always wanting to feel fully accepted, which always, you know, kind of plagued me, you know. And that would be with my peers and adults. And, you know, even though I was a very anti-authority figure kid, you know, there still is a something that you don't want to belong to the whole world. You know, and at that time, all of those things seemed like strikes against me. But then in punk rock in Los Angeles, there was such a huge Chicano population that it was, you know, undeniably okay. And, you know, I was lucky to fall in with people like bands like the Screamers and whose leading people were, you know, came from the drag scene in New York City and theater of the absurd and things like that, you know. So that was, you know, that I felt like, oh, we're always looking for the tribe, you know, and I thought these people are my tribe. And so my earliest exposure to rock, punk rock. So it was kind of good for me because glam rock had, you know, if nothing else, bisexual facade, you know, enough to you know, I'll go into that fantasy, sure. And it's going to serve me. Yes. And punk, yeah, it was anything goes, you know, when punk started. And I, you know, had read about it, even British punk, you know, that Bromley Contingent and Susie and all these people, you know.
There's a great story about going to Disneyland with Susie.
Oh, yes.
It's really one of the best stories in the book. And you just can see it. And
yes.
They're just the Disney cops, as you call them, are just horrified. Yes. It's a sweltering hot day, all dressed in black and all very gothic. taking the rides. I'd never heard that story before.
So. Yeah.
That was a joy. I was talking of sort of, you know, gothically for a second. I was curious, on the back of what you've just been talking about, how it felt to be in, you know, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. I mean, you write rather brilliantly that Nick Cave cast me, quote unquote, in the Bad Seeds as a, quote unquote, killer lesbian Mexican mobster. I mean, those are obviously your words and not Nick's.
Yes.
But I mean, that's clearly how you saw how he saw you. I mean, so
yeah.
So tell us how it. I would say the Bad Seeds was a lot of machismo there. This sort of macabre Berlin machismo that you.
Yes.
With you know, a lot of heroin and shit going on. I mean, how did it feel to be in the Bad Seeds?
Well, I was on heroin. I didn't feel anything.
So we can't really talk about that. Yeah.
No,
that segment
before.
Let's move on.
There were realistic moments in that episode. Well, it felt you know, I was a huge fan and admirer of the music and definitely. Of the work, you know, that was going on, you know, with Nick. I was dumbfounded that they asked me to play, you know. And it was also that I was just asked to fill in for one tour, so I didn't expect more than a few weeks of shows, you know, to be involved. But as it turned out, I ended up, you know, moving to Berlin because I was ready to make a move. And like everything else, I've just staked my claim. I'm staying here. I'm staying in the Bad Seeds. And but the feeling, like, I felt, it was the first time I was in a band where I felt myself personally out of my depth, you know. And that will take many different, back on the psychiatrist's couch, many different forms, you know, sexuality, one being one of them. I mean, I know that they're very open-minded, liberal people, hedonistic, you know, homosexuality is not a big deal. You know, they had gay friends, they had lots of queer friends, you know, it was not a big deal, but this is something, but their own, where I fit in here, this is where I put the pressure only up, you know, on myself, you know, that I was like, oh, I really don't fit here, you know, with this. And that started a sort of self suppression and a self negation, really, of sexuality, which is a strange thing to do in Berlin. But that's far too psychological to go on about here. And it all ended, so it's fine. But, you know, and musically, it was, I was like, oh, yeah, they're playing this blues, you know, influence music. And it was actually, you know, much more complicated and nuanced than I had played before. I came from 12-bar blues, you know, three, you know, type of situation with the Cramps and the Gun Club. You know, it wasn't music that was rewriting the wheel or anything, you know. It was an interpretation of those, that style. But the Bad Seeds had very odd timings, a lot of piano led songs that were written on piano. I had already known about singer, but sometimes the music just had to follow what the singer was, yeah, what Nick was doing, you know. And it took many different forms.
Who's that young doll in flames? For up jumped the devil and he staked his claim.
At the very end of your book, Kid, you talk about this dream you have of the late Geoffrey Lee Pierce coming back to your old kitchen, your family home in La Puente. And in tow is none other than Brian Eno. And it's a very poignant dream, actually, in a very poignant way of ending the book, particularly as you've just said that, you know, you're coming up for like 25 years clean now. So this, you know, you're a great success story in terms of recovery, which is really nice. And so congrats on that. As it happens, we decided to make the week's new audio interview a 1992 conversation with Brian Eno, none other than, because he has a new album out. So Mark is going to tell us just a bit about this audio.
Yeah, it's Mark Sinker undertook it for The Wire. Now, because it's for The Wire, you've got to understand this is fairly highfalutin stuff. You have the resident sort of self-appointed intellectual of British rock and roll being interviewed by Mark Sinker. This is heavy going, but it's actually really good. He starts off talking about youth and cultural identity and the value of pretense and how he likes the fact that, well, he hated the way that the British rock press would mock people who they thought were posing. And they had this kind of entirely bogus notion of authenticity, which involved leather jackets and so on and so forth. Let's have a listen to this first clip, Jasper.
This is so central to British rock criticism. You know, the especially the, not, I think it's less so now, but certainly the late 70s, early 80s critics were convinced that there were arty pansies like me, and on the other hand, these real committed, live-the-life rock and rollers like Keith Richards and Jim Morrison, and people like that, the guys who would die for it, and those were the real ones, you know. And that really pissed me off. I just, what a stupid idea. And what? How much of a reflection of their own lack of faith in their own lives that reflected, I thought, you know. So all the people who were writing like that all sort of looked so dangerous. They wore black leather jackets with big studs and, you know, always hanging around as if they were about to do something really much more dangerous than call me pretentious, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, that's very early in the interview. It's a really good start, I think. He talks about, I mean, lots of sort of typical kind of Eno notions, like the use of irony and so on and so forth.
That's great. I mean, he quotes from Richard Rorty's Contingency, Irony and Solidarity. Yes! It was a super thing to listen to from a philosophical perspective, hearing Brian Eno getting deep into that.
I must point out that at this point that Jasper is a fully qualified philosopher. so he's read this shit. We'll play another clip now, which is marvellous. It's all about accidents and contingency and so on and so forth, and about how joining Roxy Music, if he had got into a different carriage and a train, would never have happened. So let's have a listen to this. This is great.
Late 1971, I went down to a tube station, just happened to get on the train in a particular carriage, and there was Andy Mackay, who I'd met 3 or 4 years previously at Reading University. And I didn't know him well, really. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm just around with tape recorders and so on." He said, "Oh, well, we've got a little band and we actually want to make some proper demos." So I turned up, and that was what became Roxy Music, you see. Now, I often think it would have been so easy to have got on in the next carriage, and I would have had a completely different life. Really, not a little different. I don't think I would have been involved in music, for example. There was no compelling reason for me to stay involved in music, and what I was doing at the time was so unlikely to ever have any success in the marketplace, that I would have become an art teacher or something.
Marvellous. Actually, as it happened, Andy Mackay taught woodwinds at my school, and I actually had an oboe lesson from him. Eno came in to demonstrate the VCS3 synthesizer and was chased out by skinheads shouting poof at him. and my art teacher was their roadie, John Ragg, and took me roadieing for them back in the very, very early days. So they were kind of like, I was, felt like was the, I sort of owned Roxy Music in some sort of weird sort of way. Anyway, he goes on about kind of continuing to make music, the problems of language, minimalism and the value of the recording studio, what culture does, how he likes creating deadlines for himself, being a contributor to the cultural conversation, the importance of topicality. You can feel time running out of breath here. False impositions of cultural values, reading and hearing criticism, and so on and so forth. It's an hour and a half of pretty heavyweight stuff, but he's always interesting to listen to. So it's good stuff. Good stuff.
Kid, you talk in the book about going to see Roxy Music, mm-hmm. I think at the Santa Monica Civic in like March 75. Obviously, Eno was not in Roxy Music anymore at that point. But I'm intrigued to know whether you sort of responded to Eno particularly in the first iterations of Roxy, the first two albums, whether you were aware of him and how kind of outrageous he was.
I was completely aware of Roxy Music and Brian Eno, and he was, quite frankly, the star of the band.
Yeah,
you know,
he was.
Over,
yeah,
here, over in America, you know, he was the most flamboyant, and he was the most, making the most original sound. Coming, you know, and it will later be very much a kind of thing I look to when I was playing guitar.
Sure.
You know, his playing, that, you know, chaotic.
Brian Ferry resented exactly that. What you said about him being perceived as the star of the band was very much the reason why that relationship dried up.
He nipped that in the bud.
In the context of Brian Eno and his new album, wanted to just touch briefly on, you know, his relationship, his creative relationship with Robert Fripp of King Crimson.
Yeah.
Not least because Mark and I went to see this new documentary about Crimson last night and found it to be absolutely riveting and really quite brilliant, didn't we? I mean, it was remarkable.
To give it its full name, it's In the Court of the Crimson King. King Crimson at 50, is that correct, as a subtitle? And I've never seen a music documentary quite like it before, and it was absolutely fabulous. And this is a band I can't say I love, but it's sucked me in.
So for this reason, we've made the long read this week, a 1973 NME interview with Fripp. It's hysterical. I mean, the documentary was so funny. I wasn't expecting to laugh so much, but you and me and Martin were just laughing out loud for about the first 45 minutes, weren't we?
Yes.
He's so extraordinary, Fripp. Anyway, so Ian McDonald goes to interview Fripp. The piece is called The Sexual Athlete. 1st September 1973, and there's just some priceless Fripp quotes in it. And he talks about Eno, because they've just finished doing the No Pussyfooting album.
Right.
And so it's sort of on apropos of that. And Fripp says, "We're both incorrigible womanizers, both wonderful examples of young Torian virility." and McDonald says, "Are you going to do any live appearances?" And Fripp says, "Well, I've pleaded to be allowed by the good Captain Eno to join Luana and the Lizard Ladies." I don't know if that's is that something from Here Come the Warm Jets, Luana? I'm not sure.
Anyway, no idea.
He's just hysterical here. And I mean, this, what I'm going to read next is so outrageous. Ian says, can you give me some sort of guide as to form this enterprise, the Fripp Eno Transcendental Music Corporation? Can you give me some idea what form that might take? And Fripp says yes, bends over, pulls down his trunks, and presents him with, quote unquote, a cinerama view of his well-scrubbed posterior and environs. I mean, rock stars just don't behave like this anymore, do they? Anyway, and then finally he says, one should see in the alchemical, this is delivered, really, I should read this in a West Country accent, shouldn't I? Not? One should see in the alchemical Eno, replied Fripp, a knowledge of cosmic events and his seeming preoccupation with bondage to be no more nor less than a mystical concern with the limitation of the spirit upon its descent into human form. I mean, let's just agree that, like, Uriah Heep didn't give interviews. anyway, it was just extraordinary to revisit that. So Eno's back, this amazing King Crimson film. Anything else to say on that front, Mark?
No, I mean, just that the movie is going to be shown in certain cinemas. I think the Everyman chain is showing it in a couple of weeks' time or something. Go and see it.
Next week, I believe.
Next week. Yeah.
Week, by the time this comes out.
Go and see it. They haven't yet sold it to a streaming service. Is anyone out there listening from Netflix or whoever, Amazon Prime, pick this
kid,
thing up.
Kid, all your contacts, please.
Yes,
I'm on it.
Yeah, pick this thing up and show it. It is fantastic.
I would
really
say it's
fantastic.
One of the greatest music documentaries I have ever seen. Wow. I'll stick my neck out that far. I thought it was remarkable. Mark, any highlights? Kid, if you hear anything that prompts an opinion or a memory, just jump in, wave your hand and regale us with your views. But Mark, tell us about some of the pieces you've added.
Last week, Dawn James and Mike Grant, who is actually Keith Oldham under another guise, do one of those things where they talk to the Stones and put all the stuff together as a sort of patchwork article. They say, Brian says he's not getting married to German model Anita Pallenberg and never intended doing so. Does he believe in marriage? Does anyone really believe in it? He inquired by way of an answer. Would he say that he's going steady with his German girlfriend? Yes, he admitted. This is from 1966, rave. Leaping forward to 1996, Chris Needs interviews Arthur Baker. And Arthur Baker says, one day, Joe Batan said to me, you've got to come to the Bronx and see this. These guys are talking over records. I'll never forget his words. He said, someone's going to make $1 million out of this. And he wanted to get a rap on the record they were making at the time. I just love that. That's just great. This week, Disc Music Echo, 25th of May, 1968, Penny Valentine's review of the Stone single Jumping Jack Flash. Yeah. And she says, yes, yes, oh yes. Raise your hands, children, stamp your feet and get moving, because the real, live, not-to-be-fooled-by-imitations Rolling Stones are back with us. A fantastic record right back in the satisfaction stakes with a solid, raving thought behind it. Mr. Jimmy Miller produced it with deliberate, heavy maracas and guitar and a feeling that all will be well with the Stones, and it is. Buy it, borrow it, beg it, steal it, anything. Just get hold of the copy and play it loudly enough to disturb the minds of those around you. You will. A number one or something's very rotten in the state. Well, dear old Penny Valentine, she got it. vivid memory of watching Top of the Pops and they put on that promo video, them with their painted faces and all that. And I'm 12 and just the hair stood up back, and suddenly the Stones were my band at that point.
It's sort of the birth of the Stones' satanic majesty, isn't it?
Really? Oh,
I know
absolutely.
The previous album was called Satanic Majesties, but actually there's nothing satanic about that at all.
No.
And this one song and that video, it's like, oh my God, the devil has arrived in Stones land.
My sister was a fan of the Stones. We had Aftermath and all. I liked bits of it. I liked some of the singles and so on and so forth. It was that record which turned me into a Stones fan. Absolutely, just out and out. Watch it! Moving on, Victoria Spivey, interviewed by a new writer on our books, Richard Harrington, for the Unicorn Times. Richard went on to write for the Washington Post. From 1975, Victoria Spivey isn't someone who's you'll find a lot in the rock press. And she's great. She says, I'm a one-style person, and if you pick up on it right now, there's nobody around that has the same idea that I have. They all have changed and the rest of them are dead. Basically talking about being one of the last of the classic blues singers. Lastly, The Police's Stuart Copeland to Sylvie Simmons' Sounds 1979. And he says, "You never seen anyone wearing one of those stupid disco sucks badges in England because they've heard disco. The only people who wear those badges are people who haven't heard it and don't know what they're talking about," which I completely approve of. It's a statement.
So, I do too.
Do you remember the disco sucks thing at that time, kid, and the burning of the 12 inches in Chicago?
Yeah.
What
could make you want to listen to disco more?
Yes, you weren't interested up to that point.
And besides the point that it was obviously also a disco sucks on a mainstream America thing, was an anti-gay sentiment.
Yeah. Overtly homophobic and racist, basically.
And racist as well.
Absolutely. That's my lot. Over to you guys.
Well, how wonderful. Yes, so I'm just going to mention a couple of things. I'm not going to quote from them, but in the context of the episode, there's a review of a band called The Cramps at the Ritz in New York from 1986.
How about that?
I know.
What a coincidence.
Just mention that. Also, in the context of this episode, we didn't mention this and the fact that you, kid, were the president, or at least the president of the LA branch of the Ramones fan club, which I love. I love the fact Jeffrey was the president of the Blondie fan club, and you were the president of the Ramones fan club, which is something absolutely wonderful about that. So from 2001, we are running sort of an obituary piece by, in fact, also the aforementioned David Dalton for Gadfly, which is really just a lovely piece about a lovely guy, the great Joey Ramone, who you knew very well. Mm-hmm. I interviewed a couple of times, and I just, he was sort of one of sort of God's innocents in a way, wasn't he?
He really is, huh?
You know, I mean, there was no like affectation there. He was just sort of genuine dude, wasn't he?
Yeah. Like, I want to say goofy, but it wasn't really goofy. It was like there was some goofiness there.
Yes. Well, I always wish, I would always love to have seen a picture of Joey Ramone pre-Ramones when he was in his glam band Striper or something. And he would totter along Queens Boulevard. I mean, he's already about 6'7", but he would wear platform boots that added about another 9 inches to his ectomorphic frame. But I don't know if there are any pictures of that.
Kid, you do talk about him falling into the, losing his balance and falling into the drum kit.
Oh, wow, yes. That's right. In Converse sneakers, much less heels. So when I first saw the Ramones, you know, they came on stage and were, you know, letting us have it. And then at one point, he just started teetering, and it was like in complete slow motion, like backwards and like forward and backwards again. And you're like, whoa, what's going to happen? And then one leg goes off. And we're like, here he goes. And then he just smashed into the drums, sending them all flying. Then Johnny starts screaming at him.
What are you doing, you idiot? Like, fantastic.
It was so great. And I was like, that was my first Ramones show. And I was like, wow. This is the most amazing rock and roll.
brilliant. Jasper, what have you got for us this week?
Speaking of high heels, I actually have Kiss and Cher, The Minder Reveals All. It's an interview Mick Brown did in the Daily Telegraph on the 3rd of September 2003 with the former bodyguard of and sort of like fixer for Kiss and Cher and like Bon Jovi and all these other people. His name is Michael Francis, who wrote a book about the whole thing. And there's this great bit. He's on tour with Kiss. He's got to get them to the stage, but it requires an elevator ride from their basement dressing rooms. Everything's smaller in Japan, he says, including the lifts. Having loaded the four members of the group, dressed in their 12-inch heels, spandex trousers, fright wigs and makeup, Francis was unable to squeeze himself in. I told them, press 6. A few minutes later, on cue in front of 68,000 screaming fans, the fireworks and explosions that heralded the group's entrance went off to reveal an empty stage. Francis eventually found the four bemused musicians wandering around an upper floor of the auditorium completely lost. They'd pressed 12. To their credit, they could see the funny side of it. They said, "It's just like Spinal Tap.
I said, no, it's Final Tap. I can't do this anymore.
Final Tap!
That was the last straw in him quitting that job. But it's just very funny stories that he tells about that whole, you know, backstage environment. And then Edward Helmore in The Observer, From Spreading Happiness to Saving the Planet, The Rise and Rise of Pharrell, which is a kind of interesting comment on the one and only Pharrell Williams, featuring the quote, Pharrell appears to be settling into his role as a multimedia prophet. He's given himself over to invocations of pseudo-mysticism, recently explaining, it's all math. You have a certain number of bones in your body. You have seven holes in your face. There are nine planets, a sun, trillions and trillions of galaxies. Oh, everything God. Quantifies to numbers. It's just bizarre, but quite funny. And David Sigerson gets a mention in that piece as well, as he often does when it comes to Pharrell. And then lastly, I wanted to mention a review of John Hopkins' album Singularity. And John Hopkins is a producer of some, actually, I really like a lot of what he does. Interesting kind of long form electronic dance, mixture of electronica and dance music. And Stephen Dalton reviews it for Uncut. And he writes of Everything Connected, a 10-minute epic that starts with a leet-footed bounce of a classic Ibiza trance anthem, then mutates and corrodes into a stew of circuit-bending, pitch-tweaking, acid-glitch sizzle. Hopkins calls this marathon track a massive techno bastard, not inaccurately. So yeah, on a massive techno bastard, that's where I want to conclude.
Thanks, Jasper. That's great. Well, look, it remains for us to thank you so much for joining us today, Kid.
Thank you for having me.
If you're listening, buy Kid's tremendous memoir, Some New Kind of Kick, published next week on this side of the pond by Omnibus. Also, do visit Rocked Back Pages, where subscribers can read over 50,000 articles and hear over 800 audio interviews with everyone from Jimi Hendrix to Kate Bush. Check to see if your local library subscribes to RBP, and if not, maybe ask them to take a trial. Anyway, thanks again, Kid. It's great to
Thank
see
you.
Good luck with the
Thank
book.
Thank you so much.
Great. It's great to talk to all of you.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Hilarious.
Well, thank you. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with Billy James guesting. Billy is the guy who did the very first interview ever with Bob Dylan when he was the head of press at Columbia Records in New York. So he's going to be talking about Bob Dylan and Laurel Canyon and Jackson Browne, all kinds of other things. He's a tremendous character. So we're looking forward to that.
Fantastic.
But for now, it's goodbye from him, as one of the two Ronnies used to say. It's goodbye from him. Yeah, it's goodbye from all of us. Bye.
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 That concludes episode 138 of the Rocked Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Kid Congo Powers. Some New Kind of Kick is available this week in all good bookshops. For more Kid, follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Kid Congo Powers. Both to Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rocked Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews at rocksbackpages.com.